Lincoln, Disc 17.
Chapter 11. A People's Contest. The attack on Fort Sumter cleared the air. The news revived the Lincoln administration, which had appeared indecisive and almost comatose, and gave it a clear objective: preserving the Union by putting down the rebellion. Many Northerners were euphoric at the outbreak of war, confident that the Union, with its vast natural resources, its enormous superiority in manufactures, its 300% advantage in railroad mileage, was bound to prevail. Surely its 20 million inhabitants could easily defeat the 5 million in the Confederacy, which grew to 9 million after the states of the Upper South seceded. Seward thought the war would be over in 90 days. The Chicago Tribune anticipated success within 2 or 3 months at the furthest, because Illinois can whip the South by herself. The New York Times predicted victory in 30 days, and the New York Tribune assured its readers that Jeff Davis and company will be swinging from the battlements at Washington by the 4th of July. The president wasn't so optimistic. Overhearing boastful contrasts of Northern enterprise and endurance with Southern laziness and fickleness, Lincoln warned against overconfidence. Northerners and Southerners came from the same stock and had essentially the same characteristics and powers. Man for man, he predicted, the soldier from the South will be a match for the soldier from the North, and vice versa. On April 15, 1861, the day after Fort Sumter surrendered, Lincoln issued a proclamation announcing that the execution of the laws in the 7 states of the Deep South was obstructed by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, and he called for the states to supply 75,000 militiamen in order to suppress said combinations and to cause the laws to be duly executed. At the same time, he summoned a special session of Congress to meet on July 4th. A tidal wave of approval greeted his proclamation. Cincinnati sustains proclamation, great and universal enthusiasm, wired William M. Dixon. Nothing can exceed the enthusiasm, 2 New York City merchants reported. Large Union demonstrations assembled in nearly every northern city. Typical was a public meeting in Pittsburgh, where thousands of citizens, disregarding all partisan feeling, vowed undying fealty to the nation and pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to defend their country. Democrats as well as Republicans rallied behind the president. On April 14th, during a private 2-hour conversation, Lincoln showed Douglas the draft of the proclamation he intended to issue the next day. The senator forgot their past differences. In a statement released to the press, he announced that while he was unalterably opposed to the administration on all its political issues, he was prepared to sustain the president in the exercise of all his constitutional functions to preserve the Union and maintain the government and defend the federal capital. Returning to Illinois a few days later, Douglas worked heroically to persuade Democrats in the West to support the president because the shortest way to peace is the most stupendous and unanimous preparation for war. The only criticism of the president's proclamation was that it called for too few men. Douglas told Lincoln that he should have asked for 200,000 men, and Browning thought he needed 300,000. But in calling for only 75,000 men on April 15th, Lincoln was acting on General Scott's advice. In addition, the president had to keep in mind the states of the Upper South, still teetering between Union and secession. They would certainly regard the summoning of a vast army as proof that he intended to invade the South. And most important of all, he recognized that the government was unprepared to arm, feed, transport, and train hundreds of thousands of new recruits. Lincoln called for troops to serve only 90 days, not because he believed that the war would be over quickly, but because a 1795 law limited a call-up of militia to not more than 30 days after the assembling of Congress. With Congress called into session on July 4th, the volunteer force would have to be disbanded by August 4th. He could have convened Congress earlier, but that would have meant an even shorter term of service for the volunteers. Promptly, the northern states began to fill their quotas of soldiers. Massachusetts Governor John A. Andrew, who'd anticipated the outbreak of hostilities, instantly replied to Lincoln's call, "Dispatch received. By what route shall I send?" Other governors used more words to convey the same message. From the far north, Israel Washburn assured the president that the people of Maine, of all parties, will rally with alacrity to the maintenance of the government. From the west, Governor O.P. Morton of Indiana pledged 10,000 men for the defense of the nation and to uphold the authority of the government. They had no trouble filling their quotas with eager volunteers. There were thousands of men like Renwick Dickerson of Nashua, New Hampshire, who wrote to the president, "I have but one son of 17 summers, he our only child, a man in stature. We are ready to volunteer, to fight for the integrity of the Union. These rugged hills of New Hampshire overlook strong arms and brave hearts." These volunteers, vowing woe to the rebel hordes that meets them in battle array, were, as one youthful soldier reported to his mother, "wound up to the very pinnacle of patriotic ardor." "There are," this lad continued, "but two contingencies, both equally glorious, either to die and be numbered among the martyrs to freedom, or live to pass victoriously through this struggle for the right and be crowned with an aureole of glory." But the states of the Upper South, still in the Union, gave a very different response. "I can be no party to this wicked violation of the laws of the country and to this war upon the liberties of a free people. You can get no troops from North Carolina," Governor John Ellis responded to Lincoln's call. And the governors of Virginia, Tennessee, and Arkansas echoed his words. All four states promptly seceded from the Union. Within weeks, all joined the Confederacy, which moved its capital to Richmond. In the border slave states, initial reactions to Lincoln's proclamation were also unfavorable. "Kentucky will furnish no troops for the wicked purpose of subduing her sister southern states," Governor Beriah McGoffin responded. And Governor Claiborne Jackson of Missouri denounced the call for troops as illegal, unconstitutional, and revolutionary in its object, inhuman and diabolical. In Delaware, where slavery was a minor factor, the governor refused to comply with Lincoln's requisition, but permitted volunteer companies to offer their services for the support of the Constitution and laws of the country. More important was Maryland, a state that nearly surrounded the national capital and controlled the only railroad access to the District of Columbia. "The excitement is fearful," Governor Thomas Hicks and Baltimore Mayor George W. Brown telegraphed the president on April 18th. "Send no troops here." The next day, the 6th Massachusetts Regiment, on its way to defend Washington, was attacked by a secessionist mob as it attempted to cross Baltimore, and 4 soldiers, along with some civilians, were killed. Lincoln wanted to shore up the governor, a wavering Unionist who tended to collapse under secessionist pressure, and he agreed, for the time, that reinforcements would be marched around rather than through Baltimore. Doubting that this arrangement would last, he said to the Marylanders half-playfully, "If I grant you this concession, that no troops shall pass through the city, you'll be back here tomorrow demanding that none shall be marched around it." He was right. Shortly afterward, Governor Hicks asked him to stop sending any troops through Maryland and suggested asking Lord Lyons, the British minister, to mediate the sectional conflict. That was too much for Lincoln. When a Baltimore committee descended on his office on April 22nd and demanded that he bring no more troops across Maryland and make peace with the Confederacy on any terms, he'd had enough. "You'd have me break my oath and surrender the government without a blow," he exploded. "There's no Washington in that, no Jackson in that, no manhood nor honor in that." He had to have troops to defend the capital, and they could only come across Maryland. "Our men aren't moles and can't dig under the earth. They're not birds and can't fly through the air," he reminded the committee. "Go home and tell your people that if they'll not attack us, we'll not attack them. But if they do attack us, we'll return it, and that severely." The threat was an empty one, because Lincoln didn't have enough troops to defend Washington, much less to reduce Baltimore. After the firing on Fort Sumter, the capital seemed almost deserted because of a steady exodus of pro-Confederate officials, including high-ranking Army and Navy officers. The most notable of these was Robert E. Lee, who declined an offer to head the Union armies because he felt he must go with his state, Virginia. To preserve some semblance of order in the national capital, Cassius M. Clay, wearing 3 pistols and an Arkansas toothpick, a sharp dagger, organized the Clay Guards, and Senator-elect James H. Lane of Kansas recruited the Frontier Guards from fellow Kansans who were in Washington looking for jobs. Lane's group was quartered in the East Room of the White House. For nearly a week, Washington was virtually under siege. Marylanders destroyed the railroad bridges linking Baltimore with the North and cut the telegraph lines. A Confederate assault from Virginia was expected daily, and everyone predicted that it would be aided by the thousands of secessionist sympathizers in the city. In the lonely hours, Lincoln paced the floor of the White House, gazing wistfully down the Potomac for the sight of ships bringing reinforcements and breaking out eventually in anguish, "Why don't they come? Why don't they come?" Every day there were rumors that additional troops, including the 7th New York and a Rhode Island regiment, were coming soon, but none arrived. Chatting with the wounded soldiers of the Massachusetts 6th Regiment, the president said with bitter irony, "I don't believe there is any North. The 7th Regiment is a myth. Rhode Island isn't known in our geography any longer. You are the only Northern realities." On April 25th, the arrival of the 7th New York Regiment changed the picture. General Benjamin F. Butler had discovered an ingenious way of circumventing Baltimore by ferrying men down the Chesapeake Bay to Annapolis, where they could be entrained for Washington. Within days, thousands of troops began pouring into Washington. There was still a danger that when the Maryland legislature met in Frederick on April 26th, it would vote to secede. General Scott was ready to arrest secessionist politicians in advance of this meeting, but the president directed him to hold off, observe the proceedings, and if it became necessary, then resort to the bombardment of their cities, and of course, the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. Neither of these extreme measures proved necessary. But to make certain that Maryland remained loyal, General Butler occupied Federal Hill overlooking Baltimore Harbor on May 13th. Meanwhile, on April 27th, Lincoln did authorize the suspension of the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus along the route between Washington and Philadelphia. This meant that the military authorities could make summary arrests of persons thought to be aiding the Confederacy or attempting to overthrow the government. Such persons could be detained indefinitely without judicial hearing and without indictment, and the arresting officer wasn't obliged to release them when a judge issued a writ of habeas corpus. The president's action at this time was of limited scope and didn't attract great attention until the arrest of one John Merriman, lieutenant of a secessionist drill company at Cockeysville, Maryland. Imprisoned at Fort McHenry in Baltimore Harbor, Merriman secured a writ of habeas corpus from Chief Justice Taney, which ordered that he be tried before a regular court or released. When the arresting officer, under Lincoln's orders, refused to accept the writ, Taney felt he had no alternative but to rule that the chief executive had acted unlawfully. He reminded Lincoln of his oath to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and warned that if such usurpation continued, the people of the United States are no longer living under a government of laws. Unprepared at this time to make a general argument for broad presidential war powers, Lincoln ignored Taney's ruling. The situation in Kentucky was as critical as that in Maryland. Lincoln couldn't let his native state, which controlled the south bank of the vital Ohio River, fall under Confederate control. Ties of kinship and commerce, along with the institution of slavery, linked Kentucky to the South. But a long tradition personified by Henry Clay and John J. Crittenden bound the state to the Union. Lincoln's call for troops aroused the pro-Southern elements in the state to bitter opposition. Fortunately, he had sober and responsible friends in Kentucky, like Joshua Speed and his brother James, a prominent attorney in Louisville, on whose advice he could implicitly rely. When Kentucky adopted a policy of neutrality, taking sides not with the administration nor with the seceding states, but with the Union against them both, the president shrewdly avoided a confrontation. He had the unquestioned right at all times to march the United States troops into and over any and every state, Lincoln told former Kentucky Congressman Garrett Davis, but promised that if Kentucky made no demonstration of force against the United States, he wouldn't molest her. Ostensibly respecting Kentucky's neutrality, both Union and Confederate authorities worked surreptitiously to strengthen their supporters in the state. Lincoln named Robert Anderson, the hero of Fort Sumter and a native of Kentucky, commander of the newly created Military Department of Kentucky, which embraced all of the state within 100 miles of the Ohio River. And he authorized William Nelson, another Kentucky native, secretly to distribute 5,000 stand of arms to the Unionists in the state. But he avoided hostilities during the uneasy neutrality, recognizing that Unionism was growing faster in Kentucky than secessionist sentiment. Less successful was Lincoln's handling of Missouri. a border slave state of enormous strategic importance because it controlled traffic on the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri River network, so vital to the Northwest. Not familiar with the politics of the state, Lincoln had to rely on the Blairs, whose primary interest was in promoting the political fortunes of Frank Blair. The pro-Southern faction in eastern Missouri rallied at Camp Jackson, named after the pro-secession governor, just outside St. Louis, while the pro-Union forces organized inside that city under the command of the aggressive Nathaniel Lyon. When Lyon forced the men at Camp Jackson to surrender, fighting broke out in the streets of the city, and 28 deaths resulted. Governor Jackson then formed a military force and put it under the control of ex-Governor Sterling Price. General William A. Harney, who commanded the military department of the West, worked out a truce with Price roughly comparable to the neutrality established in Kentucky. But Lyon, backed by the Blairs, undermined Harney's support in Washington, and Lincoln failed to support the truce. Internecine war resulted. Lincoln was less involved in attempts to hold Virginia in the Union. Delegates from the strongly Unionist western counties, outraged when the state convention voted to secede, returned to their homes resolved to secede from secession. A Unionist convention held at Wheeling, in effect, set up a rival government to the Confederate government of Virginia in Richmond, and elected Francis H. Pierpont governor. The convention also called for the creation of a new state out of the western counties of Virginia. Since the Constitution provides that no state shall be divided without its own permission, the Pierpont regime was set up as a kind of puppet government that would consent to this proposed partition. Pierpont fulfilled his function. Ostensibly speaking for the entire state of Virginia, he approved the secession of the western counties, which then applied for admission to the Union as the state of West Virginia. The Pierpont administration left Wheeling and spent the rest of the war under the shelter of federal guns at Alexandria. The whole process of partitioning Virginia was extraordinarily complicated and largely extra-legal. And at a time of great unrest when thieves, bandits, and desperate men roamed the countryside, neither the Pierpont regime nor the new government of West Virginia had the backing of more than a minority of the citizens. Lincoln could do little to shape the course of events. He extended formal recognition of Pierpont's regime as the legitimate government of all of Virginia, though it controlled only a few counties behind the Union lines, and he looked with considerable skepticism on the movement for statehood for West Virginia. While maintaining a tenuous hold on the border states, Lincoln took steps to increase Northern preparedness. On May 3rd, he called up additional volunteers, this time for 3 years. Without waiting for congressional authorization, he also expanded the regular United States Army by adding 8 regiments of infantry, 1 of cavalry, and 1 of artillery, and ordered the enlistment of 18,000 seamen in the Navy. Earlier, on April 19th, he'd proclaimed a blockade of the ports of the 7 Confederate states, subsequently extended to include those of North Carolina and Virginia. 2 days later, with the unanimous concurrence of his cabinet, he dispatched an armed revenue cutter to protect ships from California bearing gold so necessary for Union finances. At the same time, again, without congressional authorization, he directed the commandants of the Navy Yards at Boston, New York, and Philadelphia each to purchase and arm 5 steamships in order to preserve water communication to Washington. In case that communication was temporarily cut off, he empowered Governor E.D. Morgan of New York and an associate, Alexander Cummings, who was recommended by Secretary Cameron, to act for the government in forwarding troops and supplies. He also authorized the Treasury Department, without requiring security, to advance $2 million to a New York committee headed by John A. Dix to pay such requisitions as should be directly consequent upon the military and naval measures necessary for the defense and support of the government. In the weeks after the firing on Fort Sumter, the demands on the president's time were incessant and exhausting. But now that he could clearly see what had to be done, he bore up well under the strain. When the writer Bayard Taylor visited Washington, he was delighted to discover, contrary to rumor, that Lincoln wasn't exhausted or sick, but instead appeared very fresh and vigorous, thoroughly calm and collected. Even Seward was impressed. "Executive skill and vigor are rare qualities," he wrote his wife in June. "The president is the best of us, but he needs constant and assiduous cooperation." Lincoln's July 4, 1861 message to the special session of Congress offered a full explanation of the course he'd pursued in the Sumter crisis. Blamed the Southerners for beginning the conflict, and defended the subsequent actions he'd taken to sustain the Union. Valuable as history, the message was more significant as prediction. Taken together with his proclamation of April 15th, it clearly defined Lincoln's view of the war and explained how he intended to prosecute it. The conflict, he consistently maintained, was not a war between the government of the United States and that of the Confederate States of America. So to define it would acknowledge that the Union wasn't a perpetual one and that secession was constitutional. This Lincoln couldn't even tacitly admit. Throughout the next 4 years, he sustained the legal fiction that the war was an insurrection of individuals in the southern states, who joined in combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. Though he sometimes referred to the conflict as a civil war, he usually called it a rebellion, a term he employed more than 400 times in his messages and letters. He never recognized that any of the southern states was or could be out of the Union, and he didn't identify the enemy as the Confederate States of America. On the very rare occasions he was forced to refer to that government, it was always as the so-called Confederate States of America. In the years ahead, Lincoln wasn't always able to keep to the purest formulation of his interpretation of the war. Had he done so, captured Confederate soldiers would have been treated as criminals and captured Southern seamen as pirates. This, as Jefferson Davis bluntly warned him, could only lead to retaliation. Without any public announcement, the Lincoln administration modified its position. Throughout the war, captured Confederate soldiers and sailors were confined in prison camps, camps that were, in both the Union and the Confederacy, overcrowded and squalid beyond belief, but were nevertheless preferable to the common jails where these prisoners might have been sent. Lincoln's view of the war as simply a domestic insurrection was also contradicted by the naval blockade he imposed on southern ports. As both Secretary Welles and Charles Sumner advised, Under international law, his proper course was to close all southern ports. A blockade was an instrument of war between two belligerent powers. By imposing it, the president was tacitly recognizing the Confederacy as a belligerent. But Lincoln was convinced that an order closing the ports would be repeatedly tested by foreign vessels, and that conflict with the European naval powers would result, and he ordered the blockade. Thaddeus Stevens, leader of the Pennsylvania Republicans, ridiculed this as a great blunder and absurdity, because in legal terms it meant we were blockading ourselves. When he angrily confronted the president over this issue, Lincoln put on his best simple countryman air and said, "I don't know anything about the law of nations, and I thought it was all right." "As a lawyer, Mr. Lincoln," Stevens remarked, "I should have supposed you would have seen the difficulty at once." "Oh, well," the president replied, "I'm a good enough lawyer in a Western law court, I suppose, but we don't practice the law of nations up there, and I supposed Seward knew all about it, and I left it to him. But it's done now and can't be helped," he added, to Stevens's fury, "so we must get along as well as we can." With these exceptions, Lincoln adhered to his definition of the war, and throughout the next 4 years, the implications of his decision were far-reaching, because in his eyes, the Confederacy didn't exist. There could never be any negotiations leading to recognition or a peace treaty. Because the insurrection was the work of individuals, not of any organized government, the states of the South remained in the Union throughout the war, fully entitled to all the protections guaranteed by the Constitution. Those guarantees covered the right of private property, including slaves. Punishment for participating in the rebellion could be inflicted on traitorous individuals, not on the states in which they resided. And when victory came to the Union cause, the southern states would be, as they always had been, equal to all others in the United States. Lincoln's July 1861 message, together with his proclamations, also made it clear that he considered the prosecution of the war primarily a function of the chief executive, to be carried out with minimal interference from the other branches of the government and without excessive respect to constitutional niceties protecting individual rights. To carry out his duties as commander-in-chief, he believed that he could exercise powers normally reserved to the legislative branch of government. Proclaiming a blockade, extending the period for volunteer enlistment to 3 years, increasing the size of the regular army and navy, and entrusting public funds to private persons for the purchase of arms and supplies would ordinarily require the prior approval of Congress. But the emergency required the president to act before such authorization was granted. "It was with the deepest regret," he explained, "that the executive found the duty of employing the war power in defense of the government forced upon him." These measures, whether strictly legal or not, he informed Congress in July, were ventured upon under what appeared to be a popular demand and a public necessity, trusting then, as now, that Congress would readily ratify them. "It's believed," he added, "that nothing's been done beyond the constitutional competency of Congress." Even touchier was his decision to suspend the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, an action that touched on the power both of the legislative and the judicial branches of the government. In neither law nor precedent was it clear where the authority for such suspension lay. The constitutional provision concerning suspension appeared in Article 1, detailing the powers of Congress. But whether the Philadelphia Convention had placed it there to identify it as a purely legislative function, or for stylistic reasons, because it didn't fit elsewhere, was unclear, and subsequently became a matter of great controversy in the Congress and among legal experts. Belief that only Congress had the right to suspend the writ was the basis for Chief Justice Taney's fulminations against the President in his Merriman ruling. Lincoln made no reply at the time, but in his message to Congress, the President pointed out that the Constitution was silent as to who was to exercise the power of suspending the writ, and claimed that in a dangerous emergency, when the Congress was not in session, the chief executive was obliged to act. "It wasn't believed that any law was violated," he added. Then he went on to suggest that such extreme tenderness of the citizens' liberty, as Taney had shown, could lead to the danger of allowing all the laws but one to go unexecuted and the government itself go to pieces lest that one be violated. The next years would see greater infringements on individual liberties than in any other period in American history. Repeatedly, the writ of habeas corpus was suspended in localities where secession seemed dangerous, and on September 24, 1862, and again on September 15, 1863, Lincoln suspended the privilege of the writ throughout the country. Initially, control of the arbitrary arrests of civilians was given to the Secretary of State, and by the best count, 864 persons were imprisoned and held without trial in the first 9 months of the war. After February 1862, when such arrests became the province of the Secretary of War, the number of cases greatly increased. Most of the persons so arrested were spies, smugglers, blockade runners, carriers of contraband goods, and foreign nationals. Only a few were truly political prisoners, jailed for expressing their beliefs. It was, nevertheless, clear from Lincoln's first message to Congress that devotion to civil liberties was not the primary concern of his administration. In his July 1861 message, Lincoln palliated such transgressions of constitutional niceties because of the importance of the struggle in which the country was engaged. At issue in the contest was more than the fate of the United States. Anticipating a phrase he would use 2 years later in the Gettysburg Address, he suggested, "It presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes." More even than that, it was a struggle for the rights of man. "This," he told the Congress, "is essentially a people's contest. On the side of the Union, it's a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life." The Congress that heard Lincoln's message on July 5th, when a clerk read it in a dull monotone, was controlled by members of his own party. After the withdrawal of Southern senators and representatives, Republicans held large majorities in both chambers. 32 out of 48 members of the Senate, 106 out of 176 members of the House of Representatives. Congressmen from the border slave states, who called themselves Unionists, generally cooperated with the Republicans during this session. Only about 1 out of 4 members of either chamber belonged to the Democratic Party. Decimated by secession and demoralized by the unexpected death on June 3rd of Stephen A. Douglas, who might have led a loyal opposition to the Lincoln administration. The reception of the president's message indicated that party lines were, for the moment, unimportant. Few had the heart to engage in partisan bickering, and irrepressible applause greeted Lincoln's recommendation that Congress appropriate $400 million to sustain an army of 400,000 men, converting itself, as one member said, into a giant committee of ways and means. The Congress promptly went beyond the president's requests and appropriated $500 million to field an army of 500,000 men. In the country, too, the message was greeted with enthusiasm. Most commended the president's seemingly straightforward account of the events leading up to the attack on Fort Sumter. Several editors noted with pleasure that Lincoln made no mention of slavery or the extension of slavery in the national territories, but put the issue before the country simply as one of union versus disunion. It was no surprise that a Republican paper like Greeley's New York Tribune praised the message for avoiding episodes and circumlocutions and going straight to the hearts of the patriotic millions. But it was a sign of the times when the Democratic New York World commended this excellent and manly message, which contained more unborrowed and vigorous thought than any presidential utterance since the days of Andrew Jackson. Promptly, Congress moved to pass bills retroactively approving most of Lincoln's extra-constitutional actions. There was dissent only on the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, which made many Republicans, as well as nearly all the Democrats, unhappy. Senator John Sherman of Ohio best captured the feeling of many congressmen. "I approve of the action of the president. He did precisely what I would have done if I had been in his place, no more, no less. But I cannot here, in my place as a senator, under oath, declare that what he did do was strictly legal and in consonance with the provisions of the Constitution." Such discord was muted because the Union Army was preparing to advance while Congress debated. Pressure for an offensive had been building ever since Lincoln's initial call for troops, though nobody had a clear idea of what strategy should be followed. Initially, Lincoln, who made no pretense of having military knowledge, thought the troops should be used to repossess Fort Sumter and other captured federal installations along the southern coast. But this thoroughly impracticable scheme would have required large amphibious operations far beyond the competence of either the Army or the Navy in 1861. General Scott, the most revered military expert in the country, offered what was described as an anaconda plan, which called for cordoning off the Confederacy with a tight naval blockade while advancing with an army of perhaps 85,000 down the Mississippi River from southern Illinois. The plan had some merit, but it rested on the remarkable assumption that the Confederate Army in Virginia, which even Scott granted might total more than 100,000 men, would remain idle while the Union forces were advancing in the West. Montgomery Blair believed that a very inconsiderable part of the Union Army could put down the rebellion by distributing arms to the Union men of the South, who were at present overawed by the armed marauders that Jeff Davis has sent throughout the country. George B. McClellan, the hero of small engagements in western Virginia, proposed to gain victory by marching an army of 80,000 up the Great Kanawha Valley across the Appalachian Mountains to seize Richmond from the west. His scheme showed the ignorance of topography that was to characterize his subsequent campaigns. Despite the absence of clear strategic plans, the demand for a Union advance became explosive after Federal troops suffered several minor setbacks during the early months of the war. The most conspicuous of these occurred on May 24th, the day after Virginia formally ratified its Ordinance of Secession, when Lincoln directed Federal troops to cross the Potomac and occupy Alexandria. Moving stealthily, Union forces, including the Zouave regiment that Elmer Ellsworth had recruited in New York, compelled the Virginia troops to withdraw. Flushed with victory, Ellsworth spotted a secession flag flying above the Marshall House, a flag the president could see with his spyglass from the White House, and dashed up the stairs to tear it down. On his way down, the hotel keeper shot and killed him. Ellsworth's death deeply grieved Lincoln, who thought of this young officer as almost another son. The funeral ceremonies were held in the White House, and afterward the president wrote the young man's parents of their shared affliction, "So much of promised usefulness to one's country and of bright hopes for one's self and friends have rarely been so suddenly dashed as in his fall." The tragedy, one that would have gone almost unnoticed in later years when deaths were reported by the thousands, reinforced the drumbeat of politicians and newspapers calling for action. Up to this point, Lincoln had favored delay, but he now ordered an advance against the Confederate Army near Manassas, Virginia, where it was a constant threat to Washington. Since Scott was too old and infirm to take the field, Lincoln put General Irvin McDowell, a 42-year-old West Point graduate who had served with distinction in the Mexican War, in charge of the advance. On June 29th, Lincoln met with his cabinet and military advisors in the White House to discuss McDowell's plans, which were simple and direct. Believing that General P.G.T. Beauregard had about 35,000 men at Manassas, he proposed to attack the Confederates before they could be reinforced. Scott demurred because he believed in a war of large bodies, not a little war by piecemeal. But the president and the cabinet overruled him, and McDowell was authorized to begin his campaign on July 9th. It was not until a week later that McDowell was ready to move, a very costly week's delay that gave the Confederacy a chance to reinforce Beauregard's army with Joseph E. Johnston's troops from the Shenandoah Valley. Slowly, McDowell's army began to march out to meet the Confederate army at Manassas. That's what the Southerners called the place. Yankees found that one undistinguished Southern crossroads looked much like another, and they called the field of engagement Bull Run, after the creek that meandered near it. McDowell's plans were widely known in Washington, and his invading army was accompanied by 6 United States senators, at least 10 representatives, scores of newspapermen, and many of what a reporter called the fairer, if not gentler, sex, who often brought picnic baskets in their buggies. Assured by Scott that McDowell would be successful, Lincoln quietly went to church on July 21st. In mid-afternoon, he went to Scott's office, only to find the general-in-chief taking his afternoon nap. When the president woke him up, the general said that early reports from the battlefield signified nothing, and before dropping off to sleep again, predicted McDowell's victory. But by 6 o'clock that evening, Seward came to the White House with the news that McDowell's army was in full retreat. At the War Department, the president read the dispatch of an army captain of engineers. "The day is lost. Save Washington and the remnants of this army. The routed troops will not reform." All evening, the president and the cabinet members clustered in Scott's office, hearing more and more alarming news. That night, stretched out on a couch in the cabinet room of the White House, the president listened to first-hand reports from terrified eyewitnesses of the defeat. He didn't go to bed that night. The next day, Lincoln began to assess the damage. He learned that many of McDowell's troops had fought bravely and well. The Union Army would have won the battle except for the unanticipated arrival of Johnston's forces from the Valley. Even then, facing overwhelming odds, most of the volunteer Union regiments had retreated in good order. And the demoralized mob described by so many witnesses was largely composed of teamsters, onlookers, and 90-day troops whose terms of enlistment were about to expire. The army was defeated, but not crushed, and McDowell's troops were fed into the substantial fortifications on the south side of the Potomac. By nightfall, Cameron wired to worried New Yorkers, "The capital is safe." The immediate political reaction to the defeat was to rally behind the president. In order to make that support clear, both houses of Congress voted almost unanimously for John J. Crittenden's resolution declaring that this war is not waged for any purpose of conquest or subjugation, nor purpose of overthrowing established institutions, meaning slavery, but to defend the Constitution and to preserve the Union. That resolution echoed the pledge in Lincoln's inaugural address not to interfere with slavery within the states. But such unity was only a facade. Bull Run was a severe Union defeat, and finger-pointing and recriminations inevitably followed. McDowell unfairly received a good share of the blame. Scott, too, was condemned for allowing such an ill-prepared campaign to get underway. Restive under criticism, the old general made an apology that was more like a defense when he talked with several Illinois congressmen in Lincoln's presence 2 days after the battle. "I am the greatest coward in America," he announced. "I will prove it. I have fought this battle, sir, against my judgment. I think the President of the United States ought to remove me today for doing it. As God is my judge, after my superiors had determined to fight it, I did all in my power to make the army efficient. I deserve removal because I didn't stand up when my army was not in condition for fighting, and resisted to the last." The president interjected, "Your conversation seems to imply that I forced you to fight this battle." Scott avoided a direct response by saying, I have never served a president who has been kinder to me than you have been." Unlike the general, Lincoln was willing to assume the blame for the defeat. Coolly reviewing the evidence, he concluded that the Manassas campaign, though unsuccessful, hadn't been ill-advised. He knew that Union soldiers were raw recruits, but so were their Confederate opponents. On neither side did commanding officers have experience in conducting large-scale engagements. A crushing defeat of the Confederate Army at Bull Run could have ended the war. The president moved immediately to remedy the causes of the Union defeat. To boost morale, he visited the fortifications around Washington and assured the troops that as commander-in-chief, he'd make sure they had all needful supplies. But he also recognized the need for better discipline. When he inspected the troops at Fort Corcoran, a disgruntled officer complained that Colonel William T. Sherman had threatened to shoot him like a dog for planning to go to New York without a leave. In a stage whisper that the other soldiers could easily hear, the president said, "Well, if I were you and he threatened to shoot, I wouldn't trust him, for I believe he'd do it." Clearly, a new commanding general was needed, and on the day after the battle, Lincoln summoned George B. McClellan from Western Virginia to take charge of the forces around Washington, and to build a new army out of the 3-year volunteer regiments that were just beginning to arrive in the capital. During the next months, while McClellan was organizing and training the new soldiers, Lincoln had a breathing spell from political pressure because everybody recognized that it would take time to build a real army. During these weeks, the president and his family could, for the first time, enjoy living in the White House. Initially, they'd been overwhelmed by the size of the executive mansion, with its 31 rooms, not including the conservatory, various outbuildings, and stables. The East Room alone was about as large as their entire Springfield house. Except for the family dining room, the first floor was open to all visitors. An aged Irish doorkeeper, Edward McManus, was supposed to screen visitors, but in practice, anybody who wanted to could stroll in at any hour of the day, and often late at night. On the second floor, nearly half the rooms were also public, so that the Lincoln's private quarters, which at first seemed so palatial, proved to be remarkably constricted. The upstairs oval room became the family sitting room. The two adjoining rooms on the south side were those of the President and Mrs. Lincoln. As in Springfield, they had separate but connecting bedrooms. Across the wide corridor were the state guest room, called the Prince of Wales Room, and the infrequently used Room of Robert, who was in the White House only during Harvard vacations. Tad and Willie had smaller rooms on the north side. The younger boys found endless opportunities for mischief and adventure in the executive mansion. To adults, the soldiers stationed on the south grounds of the White House were an ominous reminder of danger. But to Willie and Tad, the members of the Bucktail, Pennsylvania Regiment were playmates who could always be counted on for stories and races. Catching the martial spirit, Willie and Tad took great pleasure in drilling all the neighborhood boys they could round up. With two special friends who just matched them in age, Bud and Holly Taft, sons of a federal judge who lived nearby, they commandeered the roof of the mansion for their fort, and there, with small logs painted to look like cannon, they resolutely fired away at unseen Confederates across the Potomac. Children in the White House were something new for Americans, and citizens began showering the boys with presents. The most valued and the most lasting were the pets. Someone gave Willie a beautiful little pony to which he was devoted. He rode the animal nearly every day, and being a generous boy, often allowed Tad to ride, even though the younger boy was so small that his legs stuck straight out on the sides. Especially cherished were two small goats, Nanko and Nanny, which frisked on the White House grounds and, when they had an opportunity, tore up the White House garden. At times, the animals, like the general public, seemed to have the run of the White House. On one occasion, Ted harnessed Nanko up to a chair, which served him as a sled, and drove triumphantly through the East Room, where a reception was in progress. As dignified matrons held up their hoop skirts, Nanko pulled the yelling boy around the room and out through the door again. When Lincoln could find time, he played with his boys. One day, Julia Taft, the teenage sister of Bud and Holly, heard a great commotion in the upstairs Oval Room and entered to find the President of the United States lying on his back on the floor, Willie and Bud holding down his arms, Tad and Holly his legs. "Julie, come quick and sit on his stomach," cried Tad, as the President grinned at her grandly. There were also quiet times when Lincoln told stories or read to the boys. He would balance Willie and Bud on each knee while Tad mounted the back of his big chair and Holly climbed on the arm. But such relaxed times were rare because Lincoln worked harder than almost any other American president. After a meager breakfast, he went immediately to his office, where he signed as many papers and commissions as he could before the day's regular schedule began. A solid black walnut table occupied the center of the office. Here the cabinet members gathered for their biweekly sessions. Along one wall of the office were a sofa and two upholstered chairs, above which hung maps of the theaters of military operations. A large upright mahogany desk, so battered that one of Lincoln's secretaries thought it must have come from some old furniture auction, was in one corner. The pigeonholes above it served as a filing cabinet. Lincoln's smaller working desk stood between the two windows. Adjoining the president's office were rooms occupied by his small staff, equipped with nondescript furnishings. Most of the floor of this wing of the White House was covered with oilcloth, which made it easier to clean up after overflowing or missed spittoons. Lincoln's private secretary was the self-effacing, methodical Nicolay, and the effervescent John Hay served as Nicolay's assistant. As the burden of correspondence grew, William O. Stoddard, technically a clerk in the Interior Department, was brought in to help with the initial screening of the 200 to 300 letters that came in each day. One of his jobs was to throw away the letters from cranks and lunatics. Much later, when Stoddard became ill, Edward D. Neal of Minnesota, another clerk in the Interior Department, took his place. Hay spelled out the duties of these assistants when he instructed Neal to take charge in his temporary absence. "There will probably be little to do. Refer as little to the president as possible. Keep visitors out of the house when you can. Inhospitable, but prudent. I have a few franked envelopes. Let matters of ordinary reference go without formality of signature." Absolutely devoted to Lincoln, Nicolay and Hay were convinced that he'd be remembered as a great president, and they early agreed that they would someday write a history of his administration. Lincoln promised to help them. Behind Lincoln's back, Nicolay and Hay affectionately referred to him as the Ancient, possibly derived from Old Abe, or the Tycoon, in reference to the all-powerful Emperor of Japan. Lincoln always addressed Nicolay by his last name and treated him with great respect. But he called Hay John and treated him like a son. In the first days of his administration, Lincoln tried to be orderly and businesslike. He attempted to scan and digest all the morning papers that reached the White House. Finding that too time-consuming, he instructed his secretaries to prepare a digest of the news for his perusal. But presently he discontinued even that. Though he occasionally glanced at the telegraphic news dispatches in one or two papers, he read none of the newspapers consistently and almost never looked at their editorials. There was, he believed, nothing that newspapermen could tell him that he didn't already know. From early morning until dusk, visitors thronged these business rooms of the White House. In the early months of the administration, the line was so long that it extended down the stairs to the front entrance. With a candidate for a job or a military appointment perched on each step. Most of these applicants could be handled expeditiously. Lincoln quickly scanned letters of recommendation, referred petitioners to the proper department heads, and listened intently to complaints and made proper sympathetic noises. Whenever possible, he avoided flatly rejecting an application, preferring to tell one of his celebrated Leto stories to suggest how impossible the request was. When an officer accused of embezzling $40 of government money appealed for leniency on the ground that he'd really stolen only $30, the president was reminded of an Indiana man who charged his neighbor's daughter with unseemly behavior in having three illegitimate children. "Now that's a lie," said the man whose family was so outrageously scandalized, "and I can prove it, for she only has two." Remarkably, the president's systematic lack of system seemed to work. Stories of his accessibility to even the humblest petitioner, his patience and his humanity spread throughout the North. For the first time in American history, citizens began to feel that the occupant of the White House was their representative. They referred to him as Father Abraham, and they showered him with homely gifts, a firkin of butter, a crate of Bartlett pears, New England salmon. With special appropriateness, a man from Johnsburg, New York, sent the president a live American eagle, the bird of our land, which had lost one foot in a trap. But, the New Yorker continued, he's yet an eagle, and perhaps no more crippled than the nation whose banner he represented. His wings are sound and will extend 7 feet. At the same time, Mary Lincoln was achieving some successes of her own, and she became the most conspicuous female occupant of the executive mansion since Dolly Madison. Brought up with an active interest in public affairs, deeply involved in her husband's political career, she had no intention of fading quietly into the Washington background. She intended to become the First Lady of the land, a term that was coined to describe her. She enjoyed her role as hostess, and she made a favorable impression on most visitors. The cynical William Howard Russell, the American correspondent of the Times of London, found much to criticize about her appearance and manner, but he praised her simple jewelry and her very gorgeous and highly colored dress, and couldn't fail to observe that she fluttered her fan a great deal to display her rounded, well-proportioned shoulders. Noting that Mrs. Lincoln was of the middle age and height, of a plumpness degenerating to the embonpoint natural to her years, with plain features and a homely appearance, stiffened, however, by the consciousness that her position requires her to be something more than plain Mrs. Lincoln, the wife of the Illinois lawyer, Russell judged that she was desirous of making herself agreeable, and rather grudgingly added, "I own I was agreeably disappointed." She made refurbishing the White House her main project as First Lady. She found it in bad shape. The furniture was broken down, the wallpaper peeling, the carpeting worn, and the draperies torn. The 11 basement rooms were filthy and rat-infested. The whole place had the air of a run-down, unsuccessful third-rate hotel. Congress had appropriated $20,000 to be expended over the 4 years of her husband's term of office for rehabilitating the executive mansion, and she intended to put it to good use. In the summer of 1861, she went to Philadelphia and New York to buy furnishings suitable for the mansion of the President of the United States and his First Lady. Merchants showed her the best and most expensive carpeting, material for upholstery and drapes, splendid furniture, and exquisite china. Mary was not entirely rational when it came to money and spending, and having no head for figures, she bought everything, chairs, sofas, and hassocks, fabrics of damask, brocade, plush, and French satin delaine, wallpaper imported from France, and a full set of Haviland china in solferino and gold, with the American coat of arms in the center of each plate. For the red room, she ordered 117 yards of crimson Wilton carpet, and for the east room, an imported Brussels velvet carpet, pale green in color, ingeniously woven as a single piece, which, one admirer gushed, in effect, looked as if the ocean, in gleaming and transparent waves, were tossing roses at your feet. On her return to Washington, she personally oversaw the scrubbing, painting, and plastering of the White House, so that for the first time in years, the entire mansion was sparklingly clean. When her new furniture arrived, the whole place took on an air of elegant opulence. But by fall, when the bills began to come in, she discovered that she'd greatly overspent the congressional allowance, not just for the year, but for Lincoln's full term. Desperately, she tried to keep her husband from learning what she'd done. In her panic, she exploded in rage at anyone who dared cross her. Nicolay and Hay, who had to deal with her temperamental outbursts, began to refer to her as the Hellcat. She authorized a sale of second-hand White House furniture, but it brought in almost as little money as did the sale of manure from the White House stables at 10 cents a wagon load. Then John Watt, the White House gardener, showed her easier ways of covering her deficit, by padding bills for household expenditures and presenting vouchers for non-existent purchases. Discharging the White House steward, she secured that appointment for Mrs. Watt, and performed the duties and kept the salary herself. None of this, however, could cover her enormous overrun of expenditures, and she had to ask Benjamin B. French, the commissioner of public buildings who kept the White House accounts, to explain the situation to the president and to ask him to sponsor a supplemental congressional appropriation. Lincoln was furious. Never, he said, would he ask Congress for an appropriation for flub-dubs for that damned old house. It would stink in the land to have it said that an appropriation of $20,000 for furnishing the house had been overrun by the president when the poor freezing soldiers couldn't have blankets, he went on. The White House was furnished well enough, better than any house they had ever lived in. Rather than ask Congress for more money, he vowed he'd pay for Mary's purchases out of his own pocket. Eventually, though, he was obliged to back down, and Congress quietly passed two deficiency appropriations to cover rehabilitating the White House.
This ends Disc 17.